and I hope you'll join me as we explore Mars, look for life in the universe, and fly through the rings of Saturn. We'll talk with the men and women, scientists and dreamers who are guiding us to a future beyond Earth. And don't forget to enter our weekly space trivia contest. That's Planetary Radio, Mondays at 5:30 p.m. right here on KUCI.
And you don't hear none of those stations playing them. Ask why. In fact, where are those stations today? Somebody better ask somebody that. The people that's most affected by this war.
From animal rights and the anti-war movement to civil disobedience and culture jamming, Justice or Just Us examines law, equality, public policy, and social activism. Tune in Thursdays 8 to 9 a.m. on KUCI in Irvine and KUCI.org.
Darling, you say you want to write a book? Well, then you must listen to Writers on Writing, darling. Authors, literary agents gabbing and babbling about the art and the business of writing. Thursdays, 5 p.m. Darling, you must. Barbara DeMarco Barrett, she hosts. Yeah, listen, darling.
On KCI FM in Irvine.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
And good evening and welcome to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California in Irvine. We're streaming at kuci.org and we're available to you 7 days a week, 24 hours a day via podcast. You can find us at iTunes or you can visit us at penonfire.com. Just click on the radio tower on the left-hand side of your screen and that will lead you to our radio page. And from there, you can view our upcoming guests, see who's been on in the past, and access podcasts from our past shows by clicking on the archives. The show will join almost, probably 175 other interviews up and available to you now. I'm your host, Marie Stone, in for Barbara. She'll be back with you next week. As always, Writers on Writing features conversations with authors, poets, agents, editors, publishers, and all those good folks who keep books on our shelves and in our lives. And tonight, it's all about crime and mystery. I'm here now with Dr. Doug Lyle, author of Forensics and Fiction, Clever, Intriguing, and Downright Odd Questions from Crime Writers. And please stay with me, because coming up in our second half hour, I'll be joined by Melanie Rehack, biographer for the women behind the Nancy Drew mysteries. So this should be proved to be a very rich, very sleuthy hour. D.P. Lyle, M.D., is a Macavity Award-winning and Edgar Award-nominated author of the nonfiction books Murder and Mayhem, A Doctor's Answers, Medical and Forensic Questions from Mystery Writers, a compilation of the most interesting questions he has received over the years, and Forensics for Dummies, an in-depth look into the world of forensic science. His published fiction includes the thrillers Devil's Playground and Double Blind. He has worked as a story and technical consultant with many published authors, as well as with the writers and producers of several popular television shows, including Law & Order, CSI, Miami, Diagnosis Murder, Monk, Judging Amy, Cold Case, Peacemakers, House, Medium, and 1-800 Missing. And if that's not enough, Dr. Lyle has been practicing cardiologist here in Orange County for the past 30 years. But it's his latest book, Forensics and Fiction, out this month and published by Thomas Dunn, that's going to drive our discussion this evening. Dr. Lyle, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for being on. Before we get too far in, tell us how you came to be a fiction consultant with presumably a busy medical practice and all the rest of it.
Well, first I had to learn forensics, but that wasn't difficult. Being a chemistry major from college and a medical physician, I know the science, so it's not a foreign language. It was just a matter of looking at all these scientific endeavors from a different direction. So forensics wasn't hard to learn. Basically, when I started writing fiction and started going to fiction conferences, as soon as a fiction writer finds out you're a physician, they want to know about poisons and what gunshot wounds look like and how to kill someone and get away with it, because that's what crime writers deal with. And so I started getting asked a lot of questions like that, to make a real long story short, I set up a website to answer questions for writers. I wrote a column called The Doctor Is In for several of the newsletters of Mystery Writers of America and just started fielding questions. And when I finally had about 1,000 of them on my computer, I took the best 180 and put them in Murder and Mayhem, which came out in 2003. And the new book, Forensics and Fiction, is basically the second volume of that. It's about another 180 or so questions that I've received over the years from writers in all genres of crime fiction.
Amazing. Now, this book and, as you mentioned, your last, they're comprised of fairly discrete, sort of self-contained questions.
Right.
Do you also review manuscripts for authenticity or entire books or screenplays?
Yes, I've been asked to do that before, yes.
Okay. And for those who haven't yet read your latest or perhaps Murder or Mayhem, as you said, this book is sort of an extension of that. Tell us a little bit about the book, how it's structured and how you came to choose the sorts of things that you decided to choose.
Well, it's actually the basic structure is similar to Murder and Mayhem in that I divided the questions into sections, and they would be like the first section would be traumatic injuries, illnesses, doctors, and hospitals, and that would deal with questions about fictional stories where someone's either sick or someone works at a hospital or that's where the crime takes place. The second section was called poisons, toxins, medications, and drugs. And this is a big section because everybody wants to know about poisons. And the third is the police, the crime scene, and the crime lab, which basically deals with how the police and the crime lab handle a crime scene, handle evidence, how it can be tested. The next section is called the coroner, the body, and the autopsy, which is pretty self-explanatory, but it basically are questions that deal with what the coroner or medical examiner does. And the last section I call odds and ends, mostly odds, because I get some pretty bizarre questions.
Yes, you do. I can testify to that.
I'm not
yes,
responsible
you do.
For the questions, only the answers.
You know, unfortunately, I'm going to ask you probably the most commonly asked question you must get, but what are the most common mistakes you see fiction writers make in this arena?
Oh, many, but, and most of them get it right by accident, but but a lot of them actually research and ask questions. I think that the two biggest misconceptions and the fault for this falls at the door of Hollywood with their limited time,
mm-hmm.
42 minutes of screen time for an hour show,
right.
That it's the one-punch knockout and it's the one-shot kill,
mm-hmm.
and they kind of can go together. You ask any emergency room physician, and it's almost impossible to kill someone with a gun. People get shot 8 times and show up in the emergency room, screaming and yelling and hollering, but they're alive and they survive. To kill someone instantly with a gun, you got to shoot them in the head, the heart, or the upper part of the spinal cord, basically. Other than that, it takes a while because you have to bleed to death. And there's a lot of, different flavors that gunshot wounds come in, but most people bleed to death fairly slowly after that. So it's not like television where they're shot, they drop dead in the story. The knockout punch, think about every boxing match you've ever seen. The guy gets knocked unconscious, and a minute later he's sitting up on a stool telling the reporters how he had him where he wanted, and it was a lucky punch. But how many times have you seen in movies where the guy's knocked out and he's written out of the script?
Right.
Doesn't happen that way. They wake up in a couple of minutes, they're groggy for a couple of minutes, and then they're mad.
Right.
Yeah, in real life.
That's great. I want to talk a little bit about science fiction, because one of the things that occurred to me while I was reading this was the notion of maintaining the fictive dream, and obviously
right.
You're instrumental in helping people maintain the fictive dream, and that is keeping material factual and believable in perhaps unbelievable settings.
Right.
And you had a lot of, a fair number of science fiction writers with, werewolves and
yes.
time travel who nonetheless wanted their fabricated worlds to act, in orderly, authentic ways. And I thought perhaps you could talk a moment about science fiction and forensics and how you think about or approach these types of questions.
Yeah, it's actually fascinating because, as science fiction and fantasy can go anywhere. And you can create a world that has rules that we don't understand. But I'm not sure how much help I can be to those people, and I'm not sure how much help they need who are creating truly artificial worlds. But most science fiction is a little harder than that, and it's based on science that would work on this planet, too. with certain restrictions. So one of the questions was, you know, what kind of evidence would a vampire leave at a scene? You know, well, they would leave blood and hair and fibers and shoe prints and fingerprints just like everybody else would. They just happened to sleep during the day and have this little odd habit of drinking people's blood. But the point is that they would follow a lot of the physics of this world, of course, because vampires populate this planet in most of the stories that you read. The interesting one that you're probably referring to was where a bad guy was going to be shot as he entered a teleportation machine, and the bullet was going to hit his head, and the writer wanted to know, would, if he was transported at that moment, what evidence would be left behind that would show that he was, because he's the bad guy, and if he goes to another dimension, they got to go chase him.
Right.
That would prove that he was dead or at least seriously injured. And would the bullet be left behind? Well, the question whether the bullet's left behind is up to him, because that's what are the rules of your universe. So the scenario is guns fired, goes into the guy's head, and the guy disappears because he's been beamed up by Scotty. If the bullet is left behind and strikes the wall and they saw blood and particularly brain tissue attached to the bullet, which could happen, then you could say this guy's either dead or seriously injured. Short of that, it's going to be impossible to know. And somebody's going to have to hop in the little gadget and chase him.
Great. I love these.
Yeah.
With that, perhaps you can read to us one or two of your favorite odd or quirky or useful questions and their answers.
Well, here's one that I do get a lot, actually, and it has to do about mummified corpses.
Oh, I love those.
And it says, how would a mummified corpse be identified is the title of the question. The question is, my victim is now a mummified body. How long would it take to identify the mummified corpse of someone who has been dead for about 25 years? I thought I could use the clothes to make the identification, but are there other ways I could consider? And the answer is the ME, which is short for medical examiner, and the forensic anthropologist would use anything and everything at their disposal to identify and determine the cause and manner of death of any corpse, mummified or not, even one that had been deceased for several decades. And if a homicide is suspected, this identity takes on even more importance. Why? Because in the great majority of cases, perhaps 90% or more, people murder people they know. This means that identifying the victim will often narrow the suspect list and lead to the killer. A mummy offers special challenges. The size, age, sex, and race of the victim would be determined easily in most cases, and this would narrow down the list of possibilities. If the victim was a 40 or so year old male of about 6 feet in height, the ME would search missing persons reports to see which ones might match that description. Clothing and other things found at the burial or dump site might also be critical. Of course, a wallet with a driver's license would help. Absent that, jewelry, belts, shoes, hats, and clothing are made and sold somewhere, and finding where they were manufactured and purchased might be critical to identifying the corpse. The type of plastic, tarp, or other material used to wrap the corpse might be identifiable, as would the materials used to make a casket if one was used. Sometimes killers leave behind digging tools or other implements, even the murder weapon, and these might be helpful. Tattoos and surgical scars may be visible. Tattoos are often so distinctive that they can be easily traced to the artist who did them. This is particularly true today. Surgical scars, such as those from open-heart surgery or a gallbladder removal, may serve to exclude some possibilities and include others. Surgical appliances, such as hip replacements and pacemakers, have serial numbers, making them very easy to track. Fingerprints can sometimes be obtained from mummies by soaking the fingers in water or glycerin. This plumps them up, and prints can often be gotten that way. Or the skin of the finger can be sliced away carefully and pressed between two glass slides. A print may then become visible. These prints can be compared with those in a database such as the FBI's Automated Fingerprint Identification System, or AFIS, and against the prints of those suspected of being the corpse. DNA and dental records may be compared to similar information available on any missing person. After 25 years, this may or may not be available, however. The identification process may take a few minutes, a few hours, a few weeks, or forever. Many corpses are never identified. How long depends upon what is found and how quickly the police and the medical examiner can match that to a missing person. An example would be that the ME could obtain dental x-rays of the mummy. If the police had a missing person who had last been seen in the area of discovery and who matched the mummy in physical characteristics, he would have the forensic odontologist, which is a dentist, compare those x-rays with the missing person's dental x-rays that he had obtained from their private dentist and perhaps make an ID. This could take a few hours or a few days.
So great. Your answers are so thorough and give the writer so many different directions that they can take.
That's what I try to do.
Yeah.
I want them to think and use the answer, and I try to avoid guiding them if I can. Sometimes, you know, that's what they're looking for, but mainly I just want to give them some facts and tell them, give them the flavor for what they're dealing with so that they can then create a credible and believable story.
Yeah, that's great. That was Dr. Doug Lyle reading from his latest book, Forensics and Fiction, out this month and published by Thomas Dunn Books. I want to talk about predictable versus unpredictable scenarios. And because the other thing that intrigued me as a lay non-medical reader is that certain cases and scenarios, usually kind of what happens after death or the use of certain toxins or poisons, the body acts in fairly predictable, routine sorts of ways. There's an answer, and though, you know, environment or circumstance might alter things, things are going to happen in a certain way. And then there's this other category of questions you had, that namely relating to accidents or diseases, particularly those affecting the brain, I noticed, where there's very little predicting what's going to happen. Am I kind of oversimplifying the two categories of
health? No, it's probably true. I think one of our least understood specialties in medicine is psychiatry. You know, and how the mind works, and had a lot of questions about memories and amnesia and things like that. Writers like getting into that.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah. Well, books are about what goes on in the character's head. Movies are about what they're doing.
Yeah. Are there things that you tend to encourage writers to shy away from because they're inherently complex or kind of beyond the scope of what you can get into in a book or a movie?
Sometimes. The classic thing is, I was standing actually with Sue Grafton once at a conference, and somebody came up and started, Miss Grafton, can I ask you a question? Started telling her this scenario about how they were going to kill someone. And I forgot all the things, but it had to do with drowning and this and that, and it was really complex. And they get into it, and she's very polite, and she stands there. And finally she looks at him and says, well, honey, why don't you just shoot him?
That must be the most frustrating part for you, or people coming up to you and expecting you to.
Why don't you just shoot it? I love that answer, because keep it simple. You know?
Right, right.
Yes, because sometimes you can out-clever yourself.
Yeah, writers never want to keep it simple.
I understand.
That's great. The other category of questions that you got a lot of were historical fiction.
Yes.
And I noticed that, you know, a lot of them related to what was going on in medicine or forensics at a particular point in history.
Right.
Are there any pitfalls besides the obvious ones of extra research that writers need to be aware of or deal with when they're writing crime and mystery or medicine in a historical context?
Yeah, number one, don't assume that what you know is true, number one. And number two, don't assume that what you see on TV happened back then. I mean, if you think about it, fingerprints were first used to solve a case in 1897 in Argentina.
Hmm.
Blood typing wasn't discovered until 1901, and blood typing in a forensic sense wasn't used till the 1920s.
Wow.
Ballistics was known. In fact, some ballistic cases of bullet examination stuff date back a long time, but ballistics really hit its stride with the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, which was 1929.
Huh.
And they, you know, Al Capone's guys came in and shot up seven guys with Thompson submachine guns and left a lot of bullets there and a lot of shell casings there, and they brought in the experts. And there was two businessmen in the audience watching the trial who were so impressed with the way the ballistic evidence was presented that they funded the setting up of the first private crime lab in the country in Chicago at Northwestern University.
Wow.
Based on that. Wow. But prior to that, prior to that, I mean, you're writing a story set in, you know, City X. If you're using ballistics, you better be able to justify why your guy figured out what nobody else knows. Now, could it happen? Of course. I worked on an episode of Peacemakers, which takes place in the 1880s. And I said, yeah, sure, you can have your guy be clever. He can dig the bullet out, and he can test fire the gun, and he can look at it with a magnifying glass and say these things, you remember, it, you know, these things look similar. I think the same gun fired is. Who's going to argue with him?
Right. Right.
So, and I think that's very clever.
Yeah.
So you can stretch the historical facts a little bit as long as you don't go crazy. What you can't do is have DNA in the 1960s.
Right. Things not to do, note to self.
Exactly.
That kind of brings me to the question of whether the tail ever wags the dog. I was listening to your wonderful interview you gave on this very station on KUCI a few weeks back with our morning guest host, Doug Hill.
Right. It was a very good day.
Yeah.
It was a good program.
It was a great program. And you were talking about some of the early Sherlock Holmes stories alluding to fingerprinting before fingerprints were commonly used in forensics. And, you know, of course, many of the technological inventions of science fiction have come to pass. And I'm wondering if science fiction crime writers ever tend to predict the future of forensics in the way they have for technology.
Sure. It's interesting because Sherlock Holmes in, I think it was called A Study in Scarlet, was a short story. As a Sherlock Holmes, in fact, it was the first Sherlock Holmes short story, I believe. He used phenolphthalein, basically, to test a stain at a scene of a crime to prove that it was blood.
Mm.
Well, that had never been done in a courtroom. That had never been presented in law until then. So he is like the father of criminology, everybody says.
Yeah, that's me.
Mark Twain in Pudd'nhead Wilson talked about solving a crime with fingerprints.
Oh.
They hadn't been used by then. This was in the 1880s. Mm-hmm. So this was a good 10, 15 years before they ever were used to solve a crime. And he also used a similar thing in Life on the Mississippi, which was a nonfiction book he wrote about his travels up and down the Mississippi, where a guy was identified by a thumbprint, and actually the thumb got whacked off or something. I can't remember the details. But so, you know, fiction does sometimes predate. But I think these people probably travel a lot, read a lot, talk to a lot of people. And when this stuff finally hits the public arena, it's actually been talked about for a while out in the world.
Yeah, yeah. Amazing. Oh, that's great. That's great.
Yeah.
How much research do you need to undertake to answer the questions you receive? Because a lot of them are like the historical fictions in particular.
Sure.
Do most of them fall into the routine body of knowledge that the doctors acquire, or do you independently research these?
Well, it's interesting. Most of the medical stuff, of course, I know. I may look up some details of a certain disease or a certain thing, but in general, I 90% of those questions I can answer off the top of my head. But the forensic stuff I have to look up, and some of the historical stuff I have to research too. Now, I've got an entire library full of reference books, but also Google's the greatest thing ever invented.
Mm-hmm.
It's also dangerous if you don't have a filter with which to look at all this stuff. If you don't have a certain level of background knowledge, you can get really confused out there, but you can't separate the wheat from the chaff. And in my help with writers, that's what I feel my job is I'm a translator.
Mm-hmm.
I take things that they don't understand and make them understand it. So when I do my research, it's always to an eye to how can I explain this to someone who's not scientifically or medically oriented.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah, it's you're like I alluded to before. Your in-depth response to all of the questions is just stunning. It's really, I highly recommend this for all of the crime writers out there because it's an invaluable resource. It's just incredible. The other thing, I realize this wasn't the intent of your book, but I found this a wonderful resource to use for writing exercises because it's filled with 188. I counted all of them, 188 weird and stimulating scenarios that really let the imagination run. Do you use any of the questions you receive for kind of inspiration for your own fictive work?
Oh, I think, you know, subconsciously, sure. And I think that to me, besides the fact that I enjoy this book, I like this book and I like Murder Medium, I enjoyed writing it, I enjoyed researching it, and I would enjoy reading it if somebody else wrote it because it is fun stuff.
Yeah.
And if I hadn't researched it, I'd be glad to read the stuff that somebody else researched, because it is fun stuff. But I think for a writer, what it does is it opens your mind. Mm-hmm. You read about somebody's question, somebody's scenario, and you start thinking about your story or a story that you've kind of put aside. You know, let me put this little twist in there, this little, not identical, but it makes you start thinking about other things.
It does, yeah.
And I think that's why this helps writers.
Yeah, yeah. And what were some of the most difficult questions for you to try and answer?
None of them were really all that difficult. It's just some of them took more time than others because you really had to search things out, and some things are just hard to find.
Yeah.
You know, and you also find that when you go out on Google, you go out on the internet, you find that many of the things you run across obviously came from the same source.
Yeah.
And that same source may not be accurate. So you have to keep digging and digging and digging and digging. But I enjoy that. I like that kind of research. So when I'm looking for something for my own books, I won't quit till I find it. And if I can't find it, I delete it from the book because it doesn't belong there.
You go to your own website and submit a question.
Exactly.
Well, unfortunately, we're nearly out of time. But do you have any last advice or wisdom to share, particularly with our crime and mystery writing listeners out there?
Well, yeah, have fun with it. You know, don't let the process intimidate you. And as Bryce Courtney, the leading selling author in all of Australia, says, the secret to writing is bum glue. Glue your bum to the chair and write.
Isn't that the truth?
It is.
Before we go, I also wanted to mention that you, and I've hinted at this before, you have a wonderful website, which I encourage our crime and mystery writing listeners to check out at www.dplylemd.com. And I know questions come to you through that site,
right.
So it's worth mentioning to our writers out there.
Absolutely.
Yeah, Dr. Lyle, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us this
evening. My pleasure.
It's been so interesting.
Thank you.
Thank you. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, Melanie Rehack, author of Girl Sleuth, will be with me. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'll be right back.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. One belt in a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
Weekly Signals, every Tuesday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. Join me, Mike Casper, and Nathan Callahan for the best in reality-based radio. That's Weekly Signals. Check out the website at weeklysignals.com.
on Writing, hosted by Barbara DeMarco Barrett on Thursdays at 5 p.m. on KUCI FM in Irvine. Bye-bye.
Yee-haw!
The Sharp Show, breaking up the airwaves every Monday morning, 8 to 9 a.m.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at kuci.org. And as I mentioned earlier, this show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. Feel free to visit penonfire.com for more details on that. I'm your host, Marie Stone, in for Barbara DeMarco Barrett. After taking a rather long summer break, it's back to be nice. Been nice to be back here in the studios and talking with authors again. And I'm here now with Melanie Rehack, who I've been so looking forward to speaking with. Melanie is a poet and critic, a recipient of the New York Public Library's Tuckman Fellowship at the Coleman Center for Scholars and Writers. She writes for the New York Times Magazine, The New Yorker, Vogue, and The Nation, among others. Her latest book, Girl Sleuth, Nancy Drew and the Women Who Created Her, is published by Harcourt. Melanie, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. First off, I don't want to get too far ahead of myself, but I do want to add that this book is much more than a book about Nancy Drew. In fact, I'm not even sure Nancy Drew is mentioned in a real significant way in the first 100 pages of it. It's almost in somewhat equal measure a sort of survey of women's rights and progress and standing in the 20th century, and it's just a wonderful retrospective on the 20th century. Let's talk briefly first about how the book came to be, although so very many of us read Nancy Drew as children, some of us beyond being children. What specifically drew you into this project, and how did you undertake it?
Well, I was sort of drawn into it by accident, which I think is how you come to most of the best book subjects. I was a reader of Nancy Drew as a kid, like so many people, as you mentioned. But, you know, I grew up, and the Nancy Drew book sort of stayed in my youth until one summer, I guess now it must have been 4 or 5 years ago, and I was driving along in the car, and I heard an obituary on the radio of a woman named Mildred Wirt Benson. And I sort of perked up and listened to it for a bunch of reasons, but the biggest one was that the radio announcer said that she had been the original author of the Nancy Drew books, and this was, you know, sort of a mind-blower for me, because, of course, I thought that the author was Carolyn Keene, just like everybody else. And so I got really interested in Mildred Benson, and I went out to the University of Iowa, where she went to school, and looked at her papers, and discovered a whole second story that went along with hers, and that was the story of Harriet Stratemeyer Adams, who was the other main ghostwriter of the series. And all at once, I just sort of saw a book about these two women and the character they created that has, you know, inspired just so many generations of women. And, you know, there it was right in front of me, so I just sat down and wrote it.
That's incredible. Perhaps you can tell us a little bit about Harriet Stratemeyer, and you told us a little bit about Mildred, but just to kind of give us a sense of these women and their similarities and their differences and who they were.
Sure. Mildred, as I mentioned, grew up, or maybe I didn't mention, but she grew up in Iowa in a little town, really little town of about 200 people, and was born in 1905, and sort of knew she wanted to be a writer from, you know, the moment she could talk, and went to University of Iowa and actually was the first woman to graduate from its journalism program, its master's program. And she was really sort of a go-getter and a real product of the Midwest of that era. She was encouraged to do everything, and she had real kind of pioneer spirit. And Harriet Stratemeyer Adams was actually the oldest daughter of Edward Stratemeyer, who was the person who actually created Nancy Drew, who was a children's book mogul, for lack of a better word. He created a lot of the series that we remember and still read from the early part of the last century, like the Bobbsey Twins and the Hardy Boys and Tom Swift. And she grew up in a very different way, in a very privileged, much closer to Victorian way. She was born in 1892 and really kind of caught the tail end of that moment in history when, you know, girls were kept inside all day and taught to sew and not to speak and that kind of thing. So they were very different women, and they got to their relationships with Nancy Drew, for lack of a better word, in very different ways. Mildred was the first person that Edward Stratemeyer hired to ghostwrite the books under the Carolyn Keene pen name, and Harriet took it over later after she had taken over her father's entire company when he died in 1930.
And we should, you know, the interesting part of this was that there was such a fierce protection of Carolyn Keene by the Stratemeyers, certainly by Harriet, that almost felt paranoic after after a certain point, that that the fact that the series was ghostwritten, she did not want anybody to know that. And I suppose this was all done under the assumption that readers want to believe there's one person behind their character that they can latch onto.
Yes, I think that that's very true, and it was certainly true for the kinds of books that Edward Stratemeyer produced. He, you know, almost created an extra character for each series when he thought of these pen names. And, I mean, he did it for that reason, but he also did it for a very practical reason, which was just the kind of man he was. And that was that, you know, if he needed to change writers, he was dealing with people who lived all over the country. And often, you know, he never even met them in person. They were just mailing their manuscripts. But he needed to be sure that if somebody dropped out suddenly or their work was no longer satisfactory, that he could get a new writer and his readers, you know, wouldn't kick up a fuss and say, hey, you know, we used to have Joe Smith writing this series, and now you're telling us we have John Doe, and, you know, we want Franklin Dixon, who was the author of The Hardy Boys. So it had sort of both purposes.
Mm-hmm. And are you aware of books today that are written in this manner? Or, you know,
there are plenty of books. A lot of the kids' series are still written this way. The Saddle Club books, the Nancy Drew books, actually, are still
coming out.
Being written by Carolyn Keene, and it's kept very much under wraps.
She's
who
alive
that
and well.
Is, so, yeah, it's definitely still happening.
Amazing. And I suppose the million-dollar question, and the one that's continually batted around, you know, in all the news stories, is what makes Nancy Drew endure, and why don't other authors learn from the Nancy Drew legacy?
Well, I think, and I guess somewhere in here I'll read a little bit of the introduction from my book, which deals with some of these questions, but I think the thing that made Nancy so special, actually, or the two things, were Harriet and Mildred, and I don't think that you can recreate that kind of magic or that kind of input, you know, just at the drop of a hat. They really were both quite extraordinary and invested her with all of their best qualities, and I think that that combination would come along, you know, more than once in 100 years is probably pretty unlikely. So.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, yeah, please do. Please read to us for a few minutes from the book to kind of bring us into this world of Nancy Drew.
Sure. I thought I would just, as I said, read from the introduction, and sort of you'll learn a little bit more about Harriet and Mildred and just about some of the answers to the questions you've been asking me here.
Perfect.
Grab your magnifying glass, because this is a mystery story. At first glance, its star is a girl detective, a legendary foiler of plots and teen avatar of justice. But really, the mystery lies beyond the realm of her adventures. It's in the story of how she came to be an American icon and why she stayed one for decades. It's in the lives of the man who dreamed her up and the women who shepherded her into existence and molded her character. Most of all, it's in the long-buried secret behind the identity of Carolyn Keene, the woman who has kept generations of little girls sneaking a flashlight under the covers after bedtime to finish reading just one more chapter of a Nancy Drew mystery story. For some of us who had our flashlights summarily removed by mothers and fathers in the know, more creative methods were required. At the age of about 10, I used to pretend I was afraid of the dark so that my parents would leave the light on in the hallway outside my bedroom. Then I would flip around in my bed and hang over the bottom edge, straining to hold my book at such an angle that it would catch the sliver of light from the doorway. I would keep going until the lines literally blurred in front of my eyes. My favorite title, which I must have read and reread dozens of times between the ages of 8 and 12, was The Mystery of the Tolling Bell. As always, it featured Nancy, 18 and attractive, unusually sensible, clever, and talented, with her trademark red-gold hair, which often blew in the wind to appealing effect. Tomboy George, athletic-looking with short, dark hair, and George's cousin Bess, giggly and slightly plump, as she was in every book. The story concerned a cliffside sea cavern haunted by a ghost who was said to ring a warning bell just before the tide rushed in and turned the rocky chamber into a watery grave for anyone caught there. It was crammed with Nancy's do-gooder sense of responsibility, loads of French phrases that Nancy had no trouble translating for her pals, and fascinating information on the history and making of bells. There were the usual twists and turns, painted with none too subtle strokes. Nancy was knocked unconscious, a feature of many books in the series, and there were secret passageways and an evil man named Grumper. At one point, Nancy and George tie up a thief and sit on his chest to make sure he doesn't escape. The teen sleuth, as always, figures it all out in the end, including how the mysterious bell is being rung by the ocean tides and who's behind phony cosmetics. She pronounces her solution in a speech studded with exclamation points. "Just as I thought," Nancy told herself as she hugged the damp wall to keep from being seen. "This is the interior of the Tolling Bell Cave, and the ghost can only be one person, Grumper." As was often the case, this revelation was not sufficient to put Nancy out of danger. Instead, it led immediately to her near death in the spooky cave. She was saved in part by her boyfriend Ned Nickerson, but she was careful not to rely on him too much. The book's final exchange was a masterful display of the coy deferral that was Nancy's trademark when it came to Ned, which I loved as much as the craggy cave scenes and the road trips in the famous blue car. "Mysteries," Ned exclaimed, turning out the lantern. "Haven't you had enough of them?" Nancy was sure she never would have. Soon, an intriguing invitation would involve her in another baffling mystery, the clue in the old album. "Anyway," said Ned, "there's one puzzle I wish you would solve for me." "What's that?" "Why, you always change the subject when I try to talk to you about something that isn't a bit mysterious." Nancy smiled and said, "Ned, someday I promise to listen." Nancy's great appeal and strength, we all assumed, flowed directly from her author, the famous Carolyn Keene. Beloved as quickly and completely as the detective she wrote about, she was the woman every little girl imagined as the prototype for Nancy herself. A woman who had not only been as daring and clever as Nancy when she was a child, but had grown up to write about it. From the beginning, readers sent letters to Miss Keene by the hundreds, asking her to help them with problems, offering plot suggestions, telling her about their attempts to solve mysteries of their own, and expressing their undying love of both her and Nancy Drew. There was no Carolyn Keene. She was simply a pen name, one of many dreamed up by Edward Stratemeyer in his crowded Manhattan office. Nevertheless, we were not wrong in our assumptions about where Nancy got her power. We just didn't realize we were getting two trailblazers rolled into one. Their names were Harriet Stratemeyer Adams and Mildred Wirt Benson. Like the woman each of us imagined Carolyn Keene to be, Harriet and Mildred were modern, ahead of their times even. Outwardly very different, they had a fierce determination in common. More than that, though, they were pioneers during periods of both great progress and great regression for women in this country, examples of persistence and strength, and a reminder that even at moments in history, the turn of the century, the late 1920s, 1950s, that we tend to think of as sorry times for women's rights, there were always women who simply refused to be held back. Both Carolyn Keene's were tough when they needed to be, adventurous, and utterly unwilling to bend to the will of others. And while they disagreed with one another on the particulars of Nancy's behavior, both Harriet and Mildred envisioned her as a girl who could do what she wanted in a world that was largely the province of men, just as each of them had done. In their stories lie not only the details of women's progress in America over the last century, but the secrets behind the character who inspired the pioneers of that progress to keep going forward in the face of adversity. Like Nancy Drew's, Harriet's and Mildred's histories have remained untold until now, but once you've delved into them, you'll never again be able to think of the girl sleuth without thinking of the women behind her. It's as impossible to imagine Nancy without their influence as it is to imagine American women without Nancy's. A role model for millions of girls, she has always been that most elusive, more essential thing as well, a trusted companion. One grateful adult appreciator wrote in the early 1980s, As a 9-year-old, I felt that Nancy Drew was as much my friend as Ellen Kraloff down the block or Denise Walker around the corner. There is no higher praise, really. Governed as it is by the wild and mysterious inner lives of little girls, the neighborhood club has always been one of the toughest gangs to crack, even for a detective.
Hmm. That was Melanie Rehack reading from her latest book, Girl Sleuth, Nancy Drew, and the Women Who Created Her, published by Harcourt. Your reading brought up something in my mind, which is that Nancy, as we're experiencing right now, sort of a resurgence of Nancy Drew, seems to emerge in sort of troubled times. You know, it feels like she comes back to us in times of political or economic trouble when the world looks bad. Her, you know, her success during the Depression and during World War II, and now again in the state of our current situation, is sort of we need Nancy. And is that the case, or is that just the kind of the publisher's whim whenever we see her again?
Well, you know, I mean, I can't speak really to the publisher's motives, but it does certainly seem that she's one of those characters we turn to, as you say, in troubled times. I mean, one of the things I didn't read from my introduction was a little squib by Maureen Dowd after September 11th and when all the news was coming out about intelligence failures. And she literally wrote in her column in the New York Times, paging Nancy Drew. And I just sort of, you know, when I read that, I was sort of at once amazed, but then not surprised at all, because, of course, you know, Nancy Drew is who we all think of when we, you know, really want someone with integrity and spirit to get to the bottom of things, and certainly that was what we wanted at that moment. So, you know, I think she represents sort of timeless and ageless things that we tend to turn back to in moments of distress: stability, intelligence, integrity, good manners, you know, which may seem very superficial, but certainly for Harriet Adams, they were not. And I think there's something to be said for, you know, the structure of good manners kind of creating a civilizing influence.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think that she does have a way of, you know, reemerging at those moments.
Yeah. And also, as your introduction reading alluded to, and as I talked about at the beginning of the interview, you did such a lovely job of providing a context for these women by really including a sort of, you know, survey of the 20th century and the times that these women were living in, including the women's suffrage movement, the wars, the Depression, you know, the women's movement and the hippies, all of it was in there. And perhaps you can talk for a moment about your process of weaving together these two women's lives that gave this a really personal feel amidst all the cultural and political goings-on of the 20th century, because it really was so artfully done.
Well, thank you. I think, you know, as I sort of said when I was describing how I came to the book, you know, all of these things just sort of seemed to fit together. I mean, Harriet and Mildred really seemed to me from the very beginning just representatives of what women, you know, have gone through for the last century, and they seem to me like people that if I could tell their stories properly and you know, with real feeling, I could use them as individuals as a way to tell the bigger story. And so, you know, a lot of the things that they did in their daily lives, whether it was raising children or, you know, worrying about childcare or, you know, fighting for a job or whatever it was, just lent themselves so naturally to opening out into larger discussions of what was going on at the time. I mean, they really faced all kinds of prejudices and hurdles. And, you know, for me, it wasn't a big stretch to imagine them in their context, the things that they wrote about in letters, you know, to each other, or Harriet to her sister Edna, who also worked for the company, just seemed so vivid to me. And I think part of the reason for that is that, you know, sadly, they are things that we're still dealing with right now when you talk about, you know, issues of women and work. And for me to go through this century of history with these two women who, you know, I felt that I got to know very well, was really very moving. I mean, I was constantly aware of how fortunate I was to be able to write this book, to, you know, have a place in the world like the place I occupy, and to be a mother and a writer, and have managed to find a way to work it all out, and just how much more difficult that would have been 50 years ago or 40 years ago. So I think the bigger context became very personal for me, even though it's, you know, more historical.
No, it's amazing how history, you know, the old adage, how history repeats itself.
Yes.
It really was kind of frightening.
Yeah.
It really was amazing.
Yeah.
It was amazing. And with that, you kind of alluded to the amount of research you've done. There is just a stunning amount of research. There is a 32-page section of notes at the end of quotes and references. And in looking at the material in the notes, you know, it's not just straightforward books and articles, but it's school calendars and things out of boxes and, you know, obviously a lot of things that never made it into print.
Yeah.
How did you go about wrapping yourself around this vast amount of information and material? And when did you have a sense that you'd done enough?
Well, there was a great core to my research, which was the archives of the Stratemeyer Syndicate at the New York Public Library. And you mentioned in your introduction the fellowship I had there. And what that meant was that I had an office in the library, and I basically lived with that archive for about 9 months. I went to it every day. There were, I think, 370 boxes.
Wow.
And I just went through them. I read through every single one, starting from the 1860s when Edward Stratemeyer was born all the way up through the 1980s. So that was really, as I said, the core. And then there were all of Mildred's things in Iowa, which was a much smaller archive, but had some just incredible things in it, like her memory book from high school with, you know, football programs and things like that.
Mm.
And it, so those were the two things that I made, I think, the greatest use of. And then I visited Wellesley to look in the archives. That was where Harriet went to college. And, you know, little by little, after I went through all this fantastic archival material, I brought in books and magazines and newspapers, and you know, when I think back on it now, it seems kind of staggering to me that I did it. But I went forward, and I think I knew when I got to the end of that archive that the story was all there somewhere, and what I had to do was now go back and, you know, reassemble all the notes I had taken and the pieces of things that I had been gathering all the time, and it was there. You know, they told it. Harriet and Mildred and Edward Stratemeyer really told me the story in their own words for the most part. And what they didn't tell me was told to me by, you know, all the many, many people who have written newspaper and magazine stories about Nancy Drew over the decades.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, needless to say, it was a great pleasure to read all of these things and to reread all of my old Nancy Drews. So.
Yeah, it was just an incredible amount of, and the things that you chose to include. I'm sure there were a lot of uninteresting things that you came across, but the things you chose to include were just really fascinating.
Well, that's the sorrow of archival research.
Yeah, exactly.
The days when you read an entire box and all you learn is that, you know, somebody had toast for breakfast or something.
Exactly. I should mention I'm speaking with Melanie Rehack, author of Girl Sleuth, Nancy Drew, and the Women Who Created Her. And I also wanted to talk about racism in Nancy Drew, because there was a very interesting section on transitioning Nancy, perhaps it was really transitioning Harriet, through the 50s, 60s, and 70s,
mm-hmm.
and what that meant with respect to racism and her treatment of other ethnicities in the books. Can you talk for a moment about the racial elements in Nancy Drew and what responsibilities her authors and publishers sort of did and did not feel in dealing with the changing times?
Sure. I think if anyone who has read any of the original Nancy Drews from the 30s and 40s, and I guess we should say here, since we haven't said it, that they were first published in 1930, you know, they were very much marked by the racial attitudes and stereotypes of those times, many of which were very ugly. And so what that meant was that, you know, all of the villains and the thieves and all of those people were, you know, referred to in sort of opaque ways that describe them as, you know, ethnic or, you know, and there were often sort of caretakers who were, you know, portrayed as African-American men who were, you know, playing with less than a full deck of cards and things like that. And, you know, it's not a nice feature of those books. And it went, you know, pretty much unremarked upon for close to 30 years. And in the late 1950s, Gross and Dunlop, which was the publisher of the series, wrote to Harriet Adams and said, you know, we are getting letters from parents who are saying that they're not going to buy their children any more Nancy Drew books because they can't believe these you know, racial attitudes, and we're going to have to do something about it. And so what they did was to undertake a huge revision project, and all of the first books in the series were rewritten, and all of those things were taken out, as well as a lot of other things that were updated, things like the clothing and the slang and the cars. And from then on, they were written in this sort of new style, which also included making them a lot shorter because, of course, by that time they were competing with television and mm-hmm. movies and things that, you know, simply hadn't been around when they first came out. So, mm-hmm. yeah, I don't think that Harriet would have done it on her own. And, you know, I hesitate to really castigate her for that too much. She was definitely a product of her times, and
right.
certainly had she been a more enlightened person, she would have overcome it.
Right.
But she wasn't. You know, she was the person she was, and certainly, while it's not necessarily forgivable, it's also understandable.
Understandable, yeah. Unfortunately, we're out of time, and there's so many more things I wanted to talk about, but that always happens. But I so appreciate you taking the time to talk with us this evening.
This was
a huge, fascinating time. That was Melanie Rehak, author of Girl Sleuth, Nancy Drew and the Women Who Created Her, available in bookstores now and published by Harcourt. That's all the time we have for this evening. Before I go, as I always do, I'll leave you with a quote to mentally chew upon for the next week. It comes from the great Paul Simon, and it is simple advice. If you start with something that's false, you're always covering your tracks. Barbara DeMarco Barrett will be back with you next week in conversation with Victoria Zachheim, Ellen Sussman, and Jenny Ferrari Adler. And I will be back with you the week following. So until then, good writing and good night.